Hello, Sam Fisher.
Hi.
Tanner and Teague, extraordinaire, incredible fashion designer. I saw your stuff on Brunswick Street when you had a store and loved the style. It just felt so original and fun and kind of, and I don't want to excuse my ignorance in my knowledge of fashion and stuff, but it was suave as fuck.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah,
What is your most common feedback on from punters?
I mean, I think everyone has their own, like, and trying to categorize something, I see what I see in it and I build it for whatever reason, but I'm always interested to know what other people think of it and how they would classify it, because that's such a, fashion's such a personal thing. Mm. Well, I think our strongest feedback, though, is what really drives me and my history in terms of design is the way the garments are cut. And I think that, yeah, the most common feedback is that the way it's cut and the way it feels on the body is really unique. Mm. And I think for women in particular, you know, body shapes are so diverse and it's ready to wear as a thing, like as a ness. It has to, like, you have to build garments for a particular size and grade it up and down. Like, that's just how every fashion house works. But trying to find ways that can be a bit more accommodating to people, and that's the feedback we get. Like, you know, not to be kind of over the top about it, but we have many loyal customers who are like, you know, I wish you were around 20 years ago when I was in my, you know, early 20s or something, because it would have changed my life. Like, it would have made me feel different about who I am and how I exist just because of the cut is, you know what I mean?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
You feel great in it. Like, I've got a few pieces over the years and you feel really comfortable, and just the way everything hangs off you and fits on you feels just so unconventional yet so tailored. That's what I enjoy about it. And I don't know if that's the long t-shirts or the way it wraps around your waist or the drop crotch pants or whatever it is. What's your trajectory with, like, your vision and why you cut the way you do?
I guess it comes from a couple of different places. Like, basically what's important to me is getting the fabric moving on the body. I think as soon as you break the line of the cloth as it hangs on the body, then it introduces a whole nother dimension, you know, like, especially now, the current trend, this whole sort of normcore, post-Scandi sort of thing, everything's really flat and really blunt. And this is great. It's cool. It's whatever. But it makes it very difficult. You can't hide in that sort of space with those sort of garments. And so for me, and especially this comes from my time at Westwood, learning to cut and learning to consider garments in a totally different way. Breaking the line of the fabric makes it much more flattering. You can hide bits that people want to hide, because it's, you know, I mean, there are so many tangents I can splinter off into here, and I don't know how.
Go crazy, whatever's charming.
So everyone who looks in the mirror sees something different, right? And what you see in the mirror to, if I was looking at the same image, they're totally different things. And I think the hardest thing about designing clothes is a designer will have a particular vision for how an outfit or a garment should operate. But then as a customer, you are putting this on and you're bringing all of your-ness, you know, what you look at, what you perceive when you look in the mirror. And trying to, for me, it's like trying to design garments that have my sort of creative vision, but it's being done in a way that has those subtle nuances that accommodate the hang-ups that everybody has. And I don't want to say that in a negative way. No. It's just fact, you know, and I think that's the hardest job with designing clothes, you know, to try and get around that and understand what it is to, as much as you can, what it is to be a woman or what it is to be a man. And this is a huge kind of thing that you know what I mean?
I so know what you mean. Because my insecurity is, like, my long legs, so I always have my drop crotch or my pants saggy.
Yeah.
So that's my hang-up.
Yeah.
But to someone else, like, they wouldn't care. They just have, like, the high-waisted pants with their skinny legs and rock it and it'll look good.
Yeah. And if you were to be like, okay, I'm going to design clothes that are going to accommodate your, you know, structure, for example, and then grade that down to a size. I mean, I don't know what you are in the waist, maybe 30, 32, something. But then guy half your height with the same waist, you know, it's just not those two garments. How do you make that work, you know?
Yeah.
Two guys with the same waist dimensions, pulling it off a rack, one's 6 foot whatever, one's 5 foot whatever. It's, and so I think once you, and that's why abstract cut can be really, and when we look at the heroes in fashion, like Comme des Garçons, Ray Kawakubo for Comme des Garçons, Yohji Yamamoto, Issey Miyake, it's really about perceiving a new way or an alternate way to wear clothes that then brings in a whole nother dimension, and then it starts to break down those hang-ups and right. potentially, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So interesting. So is that one of the motivations for why you cut the way you do then?
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And what I really noticed, I mean, I studied at RMIT 1,000 years ago, and the way that we are trained to understand or were trained to understand how to make clothes is you take a template called a block and you trace that off and you do a bunch of lines that are about, you know, design interventions, and then you make a garment and that's that. It's very much almost like working from CAD, you know, it's all very flat. But then if you go to Europe, like the tradition, like the historical tradition of avant-garde sort of goes back to this woman, Madeleine Vionnet, and she was the first person to cut on the bias, and she was one of the first people...
What's cutting on the bias?
So fabric, all fabric, well, outside of knits, but all woven fabrics is like a... You've got yarns running in this direction and in that direction.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like a, you know, like a lattice in a way. And so the dimensional stability is obviously in that direction and in that direction, like horizontal and vertical, like that. So if you want maximum strength out of a garment, you'll want to cut with the grain running where the maximum tension's going to be. But as soon as you flip it on the bias, which is a 45 degrees, you get this gorgeous kind of shearing quality, because you're undermining that rigidity and that dimensional stability, and the fabric, it falls and it drapes in a totally different way. So she was the first person to do that, and the way she came to doing that is she was working on a small mannequin, and she developed, or as far as I'm aware, she developed this way of draping. So there's a whole bunch of rules around draping, but it's basically working with the cloth on the stand, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past, but it becomes this conversation between the mannequin as a volume and the fabrication, so the cloth itself, and then you as the designer with your creative intention, and the fabric will show you how it wants to move. The body is this static thing, which is obviously in reality not static, but it's this void, like the envelope of a house. You have to accommodate certain things. But that conversation, that constant interplay, means that you are moving around in a three-dimensional space in real time, and that the fabric will show you things that you couldn't imagine.
Mm.
When I learnt to cut patterns and to design clothes, you would take a concept, like some theoretical whatever it happens to be, try and blend that into a way of conceiving garments on the body, and then take it to this flat template and try and extrapolate whatever design ideas and you know, from sketching to drafting, like that.
So, and this is like live action.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, totally. And when I went to Westwood, when I had my first interview with Andreas, Vivian's husband, I was showing him, you know, my folio, and that back then I was, so this is, you know, mid or late 2000s, I was really into the Belgian deconstructed stuff, quite aggressive in its aesthetic, although it comes from tailoring, it's got a darkness and a rawness to it, and it's highly theoretical, it's like the designer's designers. And Andreas was like, what is this? Like, it's all about the garments. Where's the person inside it? And that just totally blew my mind, because I had always been incentivized potentially to think that the garment should be more than just the person who's wearing it. It should be some expression of some theory, or trying to change the way we view something. Like, more of an... And I went through RMIT fashion with much more of an art bent to it, and I was living with artists, so it was all of that. But then learning draping as a way of fundamentally accommodating the human form first, then applying some quite firm rules around how you engage in the technique, but then allowing that conversation to sort of happen with the fabrication itself. It was just like a... And that has informed my practice and will continue to do so. Yeah, moving forward.
And so how that must have been such an exciting journey for you when you got in at Vivian's and then started actually learning the thing that he suggested.
Yeah, I mean, it was very much more... That was... So Vivian met Andreas when she was lecturing in Vienna. So she was kind of like, she's the guru and he was a student, and then their relationship turned into whatever. What he said to me was really mind-bending because it was just a totally alternate perspective to what it means to wear clothes and why they should exist. But then going into the studio, and at that time I was employed as a pattern maker and they had no assistant designers, so the head pattern maker would act as an assistant designer and Vivian and the head pattern maker would work sort of one-on-one like that. And so there was this six-month super steep learning curve for me, like trying to get my head around what this technique is and why it's important. And then, as often happens in a company, there's one person will leave and it sort of precipitates a chain of whole, like a, you know, shifting of the guard. And so, yeah, the two senior pattern makers left and it... There was a situation where I stepped into that role. So after 6 months of like trying to get as much information out of these pattern making gurus, then they left and I was just like, all right. And it's one of those times, I think, in everyone has it in their career where they kind of recognize the importance of this. And if you step up and make that work, that's going to change everything. Or it's too much and you walk away. And yeah, obviously I stuck it out and it was... an extremely formative time. Yeah.
How many years were you doing that then?
I think I was there for about 5 years.
Wow.
Towards the end, like the company was in an quite a big expansion sort of phase, and so they were then bringing on a lot of other team members and they brought assistant designers on. And I kind of started to see people who had been in the company. It seems to be with a company with such a strong handwriting like Vivian Westwood or, you know, Galliano or whatever, you would be there from sort of 5 to 7 years or you would be there for 25 years. If you're in between, and I saw it happen, they would exit the company after, say, 10 years and then move into another company and sort of be expected to either replicate that handwriting, which I saw, like, you know, ex-designers going to another company and then producing more or less Westwood styles for that company, or they fail to be able to change that handwriting is so embedded in your design practice that you're no longer able to step outside of that. Mm. And so that was something I was quite cautious of. So 5 years, it may not seem like a very long time, but for me it was for sure like there either needs to be room for me to grow in this company, which there wasn't because it was Vivian was right there and that's the ceiling, or it's like, okay, what else? What's next? Yeah.
And so you took, that would have been a big, tell me about that specific pivotal moment where you transitioned to create Tanner and Teague.
Yeah. So when I went to London, it sort of happened, you know, there was a competition that I was involved with and went to Italy and then decided to whatever. But I was traveling with my now wife at that time. And so she was there throughout that whole Westwood phase. And with companies like Westwood as well, we all have this idea of the big fashion houses being super glamour and it's this, you know, super luxe facade and whatever. But ultimately, everyone's working so hard to make it work that it becomes like a family, you know, like you're spending... especially in that show time, that 2 months before presenting in Paris, you're spending, you know, every day there, you're working until super late at night, you're all eating together and really they become your family. And Kylie was inside that with me there. When my wife got pregnant, that was really a moment where it was kind of like, if we want to stay in London, we need to be in a situation where we can make that work for a family. And London, with its education system, blah, 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 was like, okay, we're really at a point now where we want to be choosing maybe a different way, and working as hard as I was for another company, was that something I wanted to maintain like that? Mm. So it was really a bunch of different elements. I did a little bit of time at another company, Mark Hazer, in New York for a bit, and in the end, like, the hometown advantage, family, like real family. Mm-hmm. So we decided to move back to Melbourne, really, with the birth of our first child, Kitty. Yeah.
So exciting.
Yeah, it was.
And then you conceived, created a company as well, then.
Yeah, well, the idea was to come back to Melbourne and as well. So when I graduated at RMIT, that collection was bought by a store called Eastern Market, which is quite a sort of artisanal but quite high-end boutique, and they're still around anyway, and then showed another collection. And at that time, when I got this opportunity to show a collection in Italy, it was really like, it was like a severing. Do I continue that trajectory? And I think every Australian artist, it's, you know, in whatever field, or they decide, am I going to keep doing this here locally, or am I going to get some experience, real experience, in the big bad world? And that was that moment to go away. But then coming back, you realize, and with Tall Poppies and with all of that stuff, to come back and launch straight into that space again wouldn't necessarily be the best idea. So I spent a couple of years working for Australian houses like Scanlan and Willow in Sydney, and just to re-engage in the local industry again. And then after we felt that we'd got enough contacts back and had enough experience, then it was like, okay, let's do this.
Right. Wow. How many years of that before you?
I think it was about 2 years in the end. Yeah.
So interesting how you strategically combated Tall Poppy Syndrome in Australia, which is like a real shame, isn't it? Like compared to LA or somewhere, totally, where everyone's trying to lift each other up,
yeah,
and connect each other.
Yeah,
it's a bit of an unfortunate thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting hang up, yeah. That one.
I wonder why. I think it's, I don't know where it stems from, but I wonder how much. But I mean, we've got a great country. Everything else seemed to be doing all right. It's just. And maybe it is slackening off a bit. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that the tyranny of distance has a huge impact here. Like, it's, you really feel it, especially, you know, as for you too, like, you go away and when you're in the Northern Hemisphere, you are engaged. Everything's so much closer, and it's so much more connected, and things that take off blow up big, like London, LA, New York. When something's awesome, it's just like,
it's a big deal.
Yeah. It's a big deal, and people really celebrate that. And I think coming all the way back to Australia, where it's so hard to get anything off the ground, and you're so disconnected from the rest of the world, like, I think it just breeds.
It's like the small town of the world. Like, Australia is like a small town, and the cities are New York, you know, or, you know, America, for example. That's a good point. It's like, it's far away. So what's the heart of, like, why you got into creating in the first place? So it was art. It was for, like, this wanting to express yourself through the physical aesthetic.
Yeah, I guess so. So I studied music first, like classical music. I did a degree at VCA, and I think with music, especially in classical music, and maybe it's the same in any classical practice, dance or whatever, you are funneled into this really focused space, and that comes with it a whole history of ways of doing things. And towards the end of that degree, I was just like, this is for sure not what I want to be doing. And I remember, and it's super clear, I remember sitting at Parliament Station on my way to VCA one day, and this is maybe a month out from my final recital, or 2 months or something. And I saw this lady standing on the platform, and she had a deconstructed pair of shoes on. And it just was so clear. It was like, far out. Everything about what that is, like the clarity of it, the honesty of it. Because I had wanted to study architecture, but I was sort of shoehorned into music because it's like, that's what you're good at. You'll only get this one chance, like, you have to do it. And as a live performer, you're only ever as good as your last performance, and nothing's permanent. You know, there are recordings, but still, that's who you were, it's not who you are. Whereas the idea of producing something that exists, and producing something in isolation and being able to then present it without the performative element, like there was something really beautiful about that. Or the performative element can be orchestrated without you having to, because I had quite some really shitty experiences in that final year at VCA. Like if your confidence is undermined in the performance space, it can be really debilitating. And
100%.
And that was where, that's totally where I was feeling myself. And so the idea of being able to produce something with honesty and integrity, but with all of this kind of latent kind of awesomeness and...
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
It's the honesty or the... Well, could you double down on that for a moment? So when you mean honesty in a way the shoe is designed, what does that mean?
I think, and now this is me talking about it, I suppose, many, many years on, but, and then this is another sort of a soapbox thing for me, like, you know, when we think about the arts and science, like on one side you have science, which is fundamentally like a problem-solving mechanism. It's a structure that's designed to be able to give us a yes or no result on something. We have a question, we feed it into a system, and that system is designed to be able to break it down into so many tiny components that we can have a black and white-ness to it. Whereas art, like real art, its sole purpose is for the viewer to question our existence, you know. And if a piece of art is not doing that, is it art? Maybe it's not art. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's furniture, or because anything profound has that effect on us. We walk away really questioning something. And what's beautiful about design is that it sits in the middle. Yes, it's a problem-solving mechanism, but it can leverage, it leverages both sides. So you can take super left-field stimulus and funnel that into this problem-solving mechanism, that the net result is, like, let's say a Ferrari or, you know, Frank Gehry architecture. Like, it gives us and it enriches without necessarily having to do anything more than solve a problem, like it's a house or it's... And so authenticity in design is where you don't see anymore why. There's just an innate sense of, yes, it functions, it works, but that form over function, it disappears. And it just, I think this is what, like, good design is. What is good design? It's just something where you know it's right. Maybe you can't even put words to it. And if you're really educated in that space, maybe you could understand why it's good. But there is an authenticity to it. There's a, you know, like Chanel says, always take a piece of, take something away. Like it's paired back to its most honest state. And in that space, you get this purity and, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I love that. I can see a parallel in Rick Rubin's production. Like, he's one of the best producers in the world, like everyone from, like, Metallica to Ed Sheeran. And he regards himself as a reducer more than a producer. Mm-hmm. Like, he just strips things out to the... And he also is one to say, show me, don't tell me. Like, we're like, you know, you can tell me, but I need to hear it, you know. Totally. And I think they're two great lessons in creative process that I found really helpful as well. Like, with cutting video, which is kind of my craft, it's such a feeling it out thing, and pulling out parts that prolong the narrative that needs to be told, and then also getting in touch with what narrative wants to be told. And I'm more the facilitator of that, you know, like the chaperone or the cutter. So it's funny, we both cut, but I cut film or video and you cut cloth. But it feels like, I'd love to know some more of your, like, hard line creative, like what good design is, things like that, because I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I've lectured on and off at RMIT for many years, so I have put a bit of thought into this stuff. And I think it boils down to, obviously there's something that needs to be done, whether it's putting together clips of footage with audio, or it's building a garment or a chair or whatever. So there's a reason for something to exist. But then there has to be this hierarchy of needs within the existence, and and the birthing process of anything. And that hierarchy is super important. And with garments, I talk about it in terms of what's the gesture of the garment. Like, okay, it's a tailored jacket or it's a pair of trousers, but what's the ness of it? Like, what's the fundamental important gesture. Component of it? And with a garment, it might be a twist that runs through. Like, what's the gesture? And then how do we strip away everything else to increase the importance of that gesture? You know, building that hierarchy, does that seam need to be there? Maybe it shouldn't be because it detracts from what's beautiful about it. And in that, and this is something else that I learned a lot at Westwood, that gesture doesn't need to be relevant at the start what the gesture is. What's important is that at the end we know what it is, and that everything that comes into making that beautiful is around promoting that primary gesture or whatever. So what you might bring to the stand or what might be the stimulus to make a garment might be, and for me, I love doing this, like the intersection of two pieces of fabric, like a seaming technique, or like for these trousers, the whole idea around this tech collection was not having any top stitch. So there are all these panels, there's all this technical stuff, but how do we strip it away so everything seems to just be floating, you know? Mm. And so in order to make this important, what do I need to do to take everything away to give that its, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And that in itself, like that constant hierarchy within the creation and perfection of something, perfection's a shit word, but...
It's like refining it though, isn't it?
When
you're pulling away the crap or the things that limit the gesture from being exclaimed, that's the refining kind of process.
The refining. And in that refining process, you might discover something where your trajectory shifts completely. Like you thought it was about this, but in the process of trying to refine and refine, you come to some sort of resolution where it's like, wow, that is magical. This is now the important thing.
Right.
And what I found with draping, because you're following the fabric and it's talking to you, and once you get good at it, you can really feel and talk with the fabric, that it might show you the way two things, like a piece of fabric wraps around and reconnects. And this connection here, this intersection, is so beautiful in itself that you might build a whole family of garments just around that connection.
And you stumbled upon that.
And that's constantly a stumbling process. Yeah. And that's what draping represents, that sketching, you're limited to what you can think. You know, I mean, okay, there's an element of serendipity with the line on the paper, but fundamentally you have to imagine something to be able to draw it, in my humble opinion, or with my experience. Mm. Whereas with draping the fabric, it's showing you this stuff. And I think this is just such a different...
It's like you're 3D painting it rather than 2D painting it.
Yeah.
But it's more of an experience because your whole body's... You're involved in it in a much more richer and subtler layer, I imagine.
And it's like, if we go with the painting analogy, rather than having a canvas that's a square, what if that canvas went all the way around? So this line, it has to come back to somewhere on the, as you move around in 360, and once you come back to there, it was here and now it's here, and how do we reconnect that? And so the whole thing,
well, it makes total sense as the smartest way to design clothes, because you're around a human being rather than just it feels very scientific and logical now, even as creative as one might get on a sketch pad. It seems very like you said before, the difference between the logical mind or the scientific function of a pair of shoes and the artistry of it.
Totally. And front, back and side. Like Gehry doesn't, or his team, they don't make architecture with, you know, east elevation, north elevation. They're sculpting stuff in 3D and then maybe, you know, scanning that and putting it into CAD programs. Like it has to come from that space. I think that like artists excel when they're put in a box and they have to find a way to climb out of that box.
Right.
You know, the more confined that space is that you are in, the more you can sort of creatively explode out of it. However, why am I saying that?
Like you need the canvas to paint on, or you need the function to be able to be an artist on, right?
Yeah, it needs to be. It needs to have
a structure.
But that structure then needs to be able to accommodate the real life, like all sides, you know. And garments aren't boxes like houses we now perceive as squares bolted on with flow and whatever and light and all of that stuff, whereas garments are just like a tailored jacket, you know. You're not playing tennis in a tailored jacket because it fundamentally can't do that. That's not what
try me.
Well, and you might split the back of it and, you know, but it's tennis players wear different things, and there are limitations in that, you know. And
then there's the exciting area of, like, if you created a garment for a contemporary dancer that was doing a particular dance with fans in particular areas, like, that's a real multidimensional task, right? To create that. Have you ever had an experience where
I haven't?
Yeah.
But I would love to, and I love the idea of that. Yeah.
Well, I suppose even if you got your models on the catwalk to do particular tricks that show off that, but then it's just like a novelty function that it'd be funny just to create a novelty function of a clothes. Like, if you're walking down the street and then you just shoulder, like, flip your shoulders so your right shoulder goes forward and your left shoulder goes back, and it kind of like flows your fabric out, that does this kind of snake spurs. Like tricks in garments.
Totally. Yeah.
My mate, he's this label in LA called Yogs. And he puts iPhone, he's got this guy in a drop crotch yoga pants, and he puts iPhone cleaners, or like phone cleaners, you know, that nice fabric. He stitches them into the inside of the pocket, so when you put your phone in your pocket, it cleans the screen.
Yeah, nice.
That's a good little function touch, I reckon.
Yeah.
That feels kind of nice on your fingers as well, so it's got nice form.
Yeah. And function. Super functional. And I think there's heaps going on, especially in China, where the majority of the investment is in, like, technical apparel, like fabrics and like 3D knitted leggings and stuff. Like, there is just so much blowing up in that space. Like, it's super cool.
So that's your, in terms of country and location, Tokyo and Paris. What's the main, like, inspiration where your artists that you love come from, where your influence comes from?
Yeah,
Europe, obviously, a lot.
Well, yeah, Yoji and Ray Kawakubo from Comme des Garçons are big in terms of inspiration. I think Ray Kawakubo is interesting because of her, what she thinks, like, whatever the hell she thinks. And she doesn't talk a lot about what she thinks, rather she presents it on the catwalk. And what the rest of the industry is doing, she's doing the complete opposite. Not because, but because, you know, in a way. And then Yoji, his shapes are just totally different. And Yoji, I know for sure, he trained in Paris in that way, like going back to Madeleine Vianney. And so I think there is this history of learning in this particular way. That being said, you know, the late Alexander McQueen, his stuff was totally, like, you know, mind-bending. And he trained at Savile Row, which is, like, the most sort of, when you think about Savile Row tailoring, it is such a thing. Like, it's got its own way, and it's so highly, you know, technical and regimented as tailoring sort of should be.
So he just punk rocked out of there.
Totally. Yeah. And then Vivian, you know, like, she didn't have a whole lot of training, but was dressing the Sex Pistols, and McLaren, you know, that whole thing, and just, like, boom, you know, out came this mad aesthetic punk, which was
so cool. It's so cool because clothes, like, just to go on the emotional deeper layer of why you like clothes, it's like a good haircut. It makes you feel good. And when you get clothes, particularly new ones or ones that you are really confident in and feel good in, and that's to do with comfort as well as that looks wicked. And it just changes your mood. It literally changes your attitude and how you bring yourself to the world.
Yeah. 100%.
So it's a pretty powerful thing, and when you see it as an artist, as you, or a designer, as you do, it's kind of you're giving people that opportunity to have those kind of experiences. So it's a very it's almost having a psychologist.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that we don't, you know, the idea of a career retailer in this country is pretty uncommon. There aren't many people who, you know, like a career waiter, it doesn't really exist. It tends to be an in-between job. But really, like, the emotional process that you is it not
get a bit closer.
The emotional process that you go through trying to buy an item of clothing, someone really is holding your hand, you know, emotionally and that sort of thing. I think with it, as a designer, like, fundamentally you have to draw a line in the sand. And if you look at designers with strong handwriting, Rick Owens, you know, Yoji, Vivian, there is a statement about how you are going to feel in these clothes, and you wouldn't walk into the store unless that's how you wanted to feel. But I think fundamentally any piece of clothing, when you look in the mirror and you see the version of yourself you want to be, or a better version of yourself, like, far out, I didn't know I was this guy, or like, and it makes me feel so good, and this is important.
It's great. And and there's so much variation in that as well. Like, if you talk about, like, the fashion industry, in a lot of cases, like Topshop, the whole a new line every week pretty much, or the new real disposable. What's your feeling or opinion about, you know, disposable fashion versus, like, quality, long-lasting?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the big thing is the environmental implication. I think waste is really not acceptable. And so fast fashion is really just not okay. However, you know, as I get older, you become a little bit more forgiving in life, because you know potentially a little bit more about the infrastructure and whatever. And you know, we can't all be dressed head to toe in Louis Vuitton or Balenciaga. Like, there isn't the funding for everybody to be able to do that. And to an extent, these companies serve a purpose. You know, for someone who isn't going to pay $100 for a T-shirt, who wants to buy three T-shirts for $7, there is opportunity for that to exist. However, I think the bigger problem is our expectations of the fashion industry, and that we now think that it is acceptable to be able to do that, and we have, as a consuming body, made expectations to fashion companies that is how it should be. You know, if it were 200 years ago, where you would have maybe a suit made for you by your mum or whatever, and you're going to wear that for the next 20 years, you look after it differently. And you know, something Vivian says is, buy less, choose well, make it last. And I think this is important.
I like that. And you can do that with cheaper stuff as well. Like,
you totally can.
Like with fast fashion. If you can buy those three T-shirts for $7 because that's your budget, well, they're going to last you a good 4 years. I mean, you know, like, if you look after them.
They could, yeah.
They could,
yeah.
They probably won't.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean.
But then we have this thing of, like, you know, it's only $7, so it's only worth that.
Right.
And this is where that schism is, you know. Like, if we, as a consuming body, decided that we were prepared to pay more for something, make it last, then there wouldn't need to be as much product on the market, and you wouldn't need to buy as often. You would spend a little bit more. Like, it's, I think we all underestimate the power we have as a consuming body, but it's also splintered and fractured in so many different, you know. So it's,
It's interesting.
Yeah.
What's it currently your greatest challenge in the creative process? Do you have any that is like a hurdle that, a procrastination maybe, or, you know.
I think the hardest part is the distance, you know, like working out of Australia and selling into the rest of the world. This is the hardest. This is the biggest hurdle for us at the moment,
right,
for Tanner and Teague. And right, it's partly the seasons, you know, like if we want to and are trying to accommodate our local customer, you can't design two collections and, you know what I mean? Like, it's summer there, it's winter here. And this is really, really difficult to get around. And I think that's our biggest hurdle.
Right.
Yeah, and it just being so far away, you know? Like, if you're not in Paris showing every season, you don't exist in that space. And also, if you're not there in front of people and pushing, that's the toughest part. Yeah.
So does that mean just more trips overseas, or are you going to relocate?
I don't think we would relocate right now. You know, kids in primary school and that sort of thing. But it's really about trying to map strategically how we bring the brand and get a little bit more, you know, marketing, PR, getting the right leads, generating that sort of stuff. We're really lucky with our Japanese supplier. They've got like 40 doors across Japan.
Awesome.
And he's a super nice dude, and he's actually coming to me. He spends like a week with me in Melbourne every couple of months because we design and collab as well as the main line. And so nurturing those kind of relationships, but still, it's like, how do you do it in the right way? But you can't endlessly chip away. You know, at some point, it's got to blow up. And and we recognise that moving into wholesale rather than retail was how we wanted to steer the business. And so we're moving in that space.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a lot of effort to get to Paris with a collection, you know, both financially and also with kids and the logistics and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you have?
So we're showing in Paris each season. So we showed three times last year, men's and women's. I was in Paris in early March, just a month ago.
Awesome.
So it's just maintaining that. And fashion is one of those things where, especially with wholesale, you know, it's 10 years to be an overnight success. And so you've just got to keep working it. You know, like...
What a hassle.
Be in your garage playing music and gigging, and eventually things start to, like, grow.
Can you tell me about your headspace mentally to be in a place where you're inspired and feel like creating, and then the days when you don't feel, or you've pretty consistent with that?
I have become really structured in my working process. We have a business mentor, and we're engaged in a fairly large entrepreneurial group. And there's a lot of talk in that space around structuring your time. And I made some pretty significant shifts in the last 6 months around developing systems for myself that enable me to not get so bent out of shape about what I was doing at a particular time, like setting up default diaries in terms of what I'm doing when I have my free time to just... But I think as well with the creative process, you know, and in fashion it's a seasonal thing, so you're building two collections a year or four or whatever it happens to be. And I find that with the designing phase, it's like a bucket. And information will sort of subconsciously be going in there, and then it gets to a point where that bucket is full, and then it just all spews out. And it's sort of like, you know, now just done a collection, come back, trying to have a little bit of R&R as well as maintaining the sales and negotiations and stuff.
Balance, isn't it?
It's huge. And so if I was to design a collection tomorrow, I would have to fill that bucket up first.
Mm.
Whereas I know that I don't have to present the next collection for 5 or 6 months, and so I can allow that to organically happen.
Great.
Yeah.
It's great. It's so important, isn't it? Structure and deadlines and giving yourself boundaries to get things done. Otherwise, you can just spend 10 years on one t-shirt.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I'd love to just wrap up with your philosophy, or like what would you, how would you say your outlook to life is? Like if how you personally bring yourself to life. Like what are your values, or if it's shared moments with loved ones, or you know, what excites you about living?
I mean, bringing something to life is to me the most beautiful thing there is. So obviously children, you know, bringing this thing to life is, I think, you know, and I heard a designer, Demir Domer, say it, but that creation and the birth of anything is an innately harrowing process. Like childbirth is a harrowing process, painful, it's whatever. And I think that any creative process has that-ness to it. Like it has to be difficult, because if it wasn't difficult, it wouldn't be as beautiful. Mm. And so if I am to step outside the busyness of my life and just look at it in that way, I think that creative process is really gorgeous. You know, like watching the kids grow and sharing how they engage with the world is super beautiful. And my wife and I, we run the business together, so we get to share the business stuff as well as kids. But yeah, being in the studio, and I mean, I don't like the idea of just contributing more shit to the world, for sure not. But if I wasn't building beautiful things, if I wasn't bringing beautiful things to life, I would much rather maybe work in a cafe where, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's for sure what drives me. And, you know, I love bikes, riding push bikes, and I love all aspects of how beautiful things can be in our life, you know, that, yeah, and in a, as passive a way as, you know, we're in the 21st century now, there's a lot of other shit going on, but if we can find a way to, if I can find a way to maintain that, this is...
You're winning. That's beautiful, man. You feel amazing when you create it, don't you? And it, like, it, I'm so stoked that you're like maintaining that, because that's the hardest thing for any artist, is to make it work, and it takes a, lot of brains, and balance, and perspective, and support, and all sorts of things to align for that to happen. So congratulations, fucking amazing,
and right back at you, man.
Thanks so much, Sam.